The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Am I dead? Is this it? Am I dead?
Go back.
Elbryon?
Go back.
Elbryon. Oh. Oh, my love. I'm so weary.
You cannot be here. Not now. You cannot forsake our son when his hour of need approaches.
Elbryon, do not chase me away. Adrian is beyond me. Beyond all the world.
Go back!
Saint Mirabel has never fallen. Not to any enemy. Not to the great Powry fleet that attacked us in the time of the demon. Not to the goblin hordes that descended upon the civilized lands. Not to the errant judgments of Father Abbot Delibert Marquardt. Not to the plague in all its incarnations. Our walls are strong, though not nearly as strong as the faith that truly holds us firm.
Fine words, brother. We will speak them together and loudly for all to hear.
When King Adrian comes knocking.
Dragon, the second oldest of the races and the most vile by far.
You knew that Bryn Dariel was rumored to possess such a beast.
So?
So explain your reaction.
I cannot explain. The revulsion within me, I had not anticipated.
Were you not joking earlier that you would desire such a beast as a mount?
I would desire its vile head as a trophy and nothing more.
We have been deceived. Duke Calus has turned.
How is this possible? Why did your scouts not detect?
Adrian and his gemstones.
We cannot fight them all.
We turn now. Saint Mirabel is doomed.
Saint Mirabel is doomed in any case.
We have nowhere to run.
Then let us fight.
And so it ends.
Don't miss the final confrontation between good and evil. The conclusion of The Demon War Saga, Book 7, Immortalis, Part 3. Available now in graphic audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terence Aselford. With performances by Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, Michael John Casey, Dylan Lynch, Yasmin Toison, Tony Nam, M.B. Van Dorn, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Stephen Carpenter, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Mort Shelby. Survivalist number 26, Countdown. Almost Sarah. Or was she Sarah? She had Sarah's memories. Was it only programming? Where did the input from another living being's memory begin and the reality of true memory start? The gunfire. She recognized that plainly enough. It made her remember the birth of her third child, a little boy. Or was she remembering? It was clearly the sound of a pistol shot, nothing else. And her husband's little office was suddenly a very vulnerable place, with too many windows, no secure door, very little potential for covered positions from which to return fire. Sarah Rourke's right hand groped for the Trapper Scorpion 45 in the pocket of her German Arctic parka, the garment draped over the back of her husband's chair. The pistol's chamber was already loaded, and she thumbed back the hammer as she stood. Pain shot through her from groin to chest. She was cold and hot at once. Fluid burst from her, spraying downward between her legs and onto the floor. Her water bag had broken. She realized the baby was coming early. Sarah Rourke, her pistol clutched in her right hand, fought against the cramping which seized her, consumed her. She was dragging herself along the floor now, into the corridor, dragging herself because she could not walk. On her knees beside the corridor wall, she sagged, felt the movement of the baby. It had to be a boy, racing to the sound of battle just like his father had always done. But not now. She tried to get to her feet, but couldn't rise. Smoke filled the corridor, acrid smelling, filling her lungs and the baby's bloodstream, too, she knew. But the back door to the hospital, the emergency entrance, was only a few yards away, she told herself. Only a few yards. Where was John? Natalia? Where was Natalia? The baby's head crowned, blood oozing along her thighs, her flesh ripping.
John!
More pain than she had ever known, and then it was gone, and blood and fluid dripped from her, but her baby's head was out. She bore down with her shoulders, her ribcage, her pelvis, pushing as hard as she could, unable to move her hands to help herself lest she fall. She drew herself in and pushed down. Movement. A shoulder. It had to be. She could feel her child alive and moving, and she let herself slide down along the length of the wall as her hands grasped for the baby, drawing the child, her child, John's child, the rest of the way from her body.
Very impressive, Frau Rourke.
The man who had spoken to her had had a gun in his hand.
This is for your crimes against National Socialism, Frau Rourke.
John!
Did the possession of memories endow the possessor with the reality of the object or event remembered? She was faintly aware of being in her husband's arms, but he wasn't her husband, or maybe he was. And she felt safe from the gunfire. But didn't she want to kill this man? She could not remember that now. Where was her baby boy, the child she'd birthed in the instant before what was almost death? For Sarah? For almost Sarah? Almost Sarah, a clone of the original. Or was she Sarah? Were the memories hers or only stolen? She felt tears in eyes that she was, as yet, too tired to open. On one level, John Thomas Rourke was truly convinced that the woman whom he held cradled in his arms was indeed his wife. She not only looked and felt, even sounded like Sarah, but the womanly smell of her was distinctly Sarah Rourke. Yet the doubt which Dietrich Zimmer had planted in Rourke's mind concerning her identity was something Rourke could neither escape nor ignore. And if she were not Sarah, he might well be carrying the instrument of his death. But there was no time for worrying about the situation now. Too much to do. Another 36 of Dietrich Zimmer's SS commandos were holding the top of the mountain where their helicopters had originally landed.
No Transglobal Alliance air power is coming.
And why is that, Commander Washington?
There's been a nuclear attack on our forces located in upstate New York. No casualty count yet, General, Dr. Rourke and Mr. Rubenstein. And no information at all except that it happened. No yield size, nothing. All we do know is that the detonation was probably an airburst, the most deadly technique for battlefield use.
And not only the most deadly, but the most efficient, too.
Natalia, with her wounded left leg being attended to by a medic, leaning her back against the living rock which comprised the wall surface of the control center at the base of the Nazi Mountain headquarters. She looked at Commander Washington, then at Rourke. Rourke was walking again, still carrying Sarah, nearly out the doorway to the half-track waiting outside. But he just stopped. His wife, he would operate on the assumption that she was his wife until and unless circumstances proved differently, lay somewhere between sleep and unconsciousness in his arms, and the world was collapsing around them. Personal concerns once again had to be put aside, and except for those 5 years he'd spent raising his son and daughter in the retreat, he had known nothing beyond mortal conflict ever since the night of the war. He was becoming increasingly tired of having no life other than that. Even those 5 years had been years of sadness and fear, too. But there was true and profound satisfaction in taking two children and seeing them through their first steps into an adulthood such as no child had ever experienced before or since. Michael and Annie had been small children on the night of the war, surviving into a future John Rourke could never have imagined.
We'll need aircraft, then, in order to anticipate a wide range of contingencies. That means we neutralize the enemy personnel above and capture their machines if possible, meanwhile securing this base. If a general nuclear exchange results from the battlefield detonation to which Commander Washington referred, this place might be our only sanctuary. The food and supplies here, our only means of survival. Michael, take your mother and—
I'm not leaving. I'll carry Mom to the half-track, but I'm not going anywhere after that. I've got work to do here. She'll be cared for, we both know that. And as soon as this facility is secured, we'll have her back here with us.
Rourke only nodded, respecting his son's judgment.
I'm not going to be very fast on my feet, John, but there is quite a bit I can do, regardless of my leg. Perhaps fly that helicopter the Nazis so kindly left us. My leg will work well enough for that.
I'm staying too, Dad. I'm still fast on my feet. We pretty much started out in all of this together, and we'll keep at it until we finish or die trying.
Fine. Then let's see if we can get Wolfgang Mann conscious so he can help too. As soon as he's got his faculties about him, we could benefit from having a real general to give us some advice, as opposed to only an honorary one.
Michael took his mother from his father's arms into his own.
She'll be all right, Dad.
I think we have our work cut out for us, ladies and gentlemen.
And they did. Climbing the cliff face to the summit where the Nazi commando force held its fortified position was madness in and of itself, the granite surface dangerous in the extreme. But with enemy personnel above who might fire down at any second, the Enterprise bordered on suicidal, Rourke realized. Yet John Rourke had planned ahead. Their greatest danger, both from the mountain itself and the armed men above, lay in the final 600 feet or so, where the angle as the summit was approached was too steep to be navigated on anything but all fours with climbing ropes to assist, yet level enough that it would be impossible to avoid detection by anyone who cared to look. At that juncture, if they reached the approach to the summit alive, Natalia would utilize the captured Nazi helicopter gunship, and the remote video probes aboard the craft would be launched, the non-essential video apparatus removed, high explosives substituted in their place. With any luck, the Nazi defenders would not realize what they were shooting at until they'd already shot, and the explosives would detonate. While this was going on, the distraction it would hopefully provide might mask the final stage of the ascent to the summit. There was no proper climbing gear available, no crampons, nor even pitons to assist them, and their options among field expedients were limited. As Commander Washington's numerically superior force worked its way systematically through the structure, daring only to take the elevators to a command post established within two floors of the enemy base at the summit, a full machine shop was discovered. One of the men with Washington's command, Seaman First Class Clarence W. Wolverton, had had some experience as a machinist in civilian life and was immediately drafted into preparations needed for the climb. Wolverton was relieved of his other duties. John Rourke took the fellow aside.
Wolverton, here's what I need.
Why, sir?
I'll get as many men relieved to your detail as you require. The type of metal I'll need for the piton should be a high grade of tool steel, resilient, yet with enough surface hardness so that it can be hammered into rock. Bolts used in association with the elevator housings might be a good place to start. Those would have to be strong in order to handle the equipment load weight limits that are posted. Can you do this, and fast? I know the equipment available to you may not be right for the job.
Being perfectly honest, sir, I don't know, but I'll sure try my damnedest.
That's all I can ask, son. Get whatever men and gear you need. You have my full authority if anybody questions you.
Aye, sir.
Rourke gave him a nod, and Wolverton was off at a trot. Rourke checked the black-faced Rolex on his left wrist. He had no idea how much time the preparations would consume, nor how much time he had left. He grabbed his parka and started for the doors leading to the outside, and the helicopter where Natalia, resident explosives expert, was rigging the remote video probes. Latest word from the field camp where Sarah had been taken for safety was that her condition was rapidly improving. Once the upper levels and the position on the summit were secured, Sarah could be brought back in relative safety. Wolfgang Mann's condition was improving rapidly as well. In a few hours, although New Germany's Premier General Oberst wouldn't be up and ready to fight, Mann should be able to offer military advice for the defense of the overrun Nazi headquarters complex. That assumption was predicated, of course, on the further assumption that this Wolfgang Mann was the genuine Wolfgang Mann. As Rourke ventured into the open, bitterly cold wind cut into him, and he pulled his parka closed around him, throwing up its hood as well. Rourke could not help but be reminded of how that wind would feel as they made their way along the face of the mountain. With heat lamps to warm the position, Commander Washington's senior radio man was attending his equipment, trying to raise anything he could find on a Trans-Global Alliance frequency in search of information and air support.
Any luck?
Nothing yet, sir, except a hell of a lot of static.
Carry on.
What about Emma Shaw? Rourke bit his lower lip. There was a significant likelihood that she was somehow involved in the nuclear incident. Therefore, there was an equally substantial chance that she had been killed.
Damn it.
He neared the captured Nazi helicopter where Natalia was preparing the explosives. Rourke stepped up and inside, the SEAL sliding the door closed behind him, then passing him, rejoining Natalia and one of the German long-range mountain patrol commandos aft. Two of the remote video probes were partially disemboweled on the deck before them, and surrounding these were coils of multicolored wire and bricks of plastique.
How's it going, Natalia?
This is not all that difficult, really. Just time-consuming, John. The same electronics which allow manipulation of the video can be utilized to trigger the explosives, should that be necessary. Or, at least in theory, they can be.
Fine. Let me know, then.
Right. Any word on Sarah?
She's coming along nicely.
Good.
How's your leg?
It only hurts when I laugh.
Fortunate that we don't have much to laugh about then, isn't it?
Michael asked me to be his wife, John.
That is wonderful for both of you.
It is insane, John. Michael and I love each other, and what we have is something I have never known before. Yet, I will be your daughter-in-law, and I cannot forget the feelings we shared before any of this happened. Am I doing the right thing? I think that I am.
I know that you are. You and Paul are the best friends I have ever had, could ever have. Paul's my son-in-law. You'll be my daughter-in-law. No man could ask for better.
I will always love you, Ivan. You know that.
And I will always love you, Natalia Anastasia.
The aircraft was well into its reserve tanks, and Emma Shaw had practiced all the fuel economy measures that she could think of. The hand-operated semaphores were long since replaced by what appeared to be a battery-operated electrical unit. She was certain that no power was available on the base as yet. Radio, except between the aircraft themselves, was still out. As she swept a lazy circle, mostly glide, around the main runway, mentally scoring her chances for a dead-stick landing, and finding them less than satisfactory, she spied another aircraft identical to her own and those of her squadron. It was taking off into the wind.
This is Communicator One calling Bulldog Leader. Do you copy? Over.
This is Bulldog Leader, Communicator One, reading you loud and clear. Over.
Bulldog Leader, this is Communicator One. All ground-based electrical systems are still out. You copy that? Over.
Affirmative, Communicator One.
Am switching to LRF-9, Bulldog Leader. We'll continue on that frequency. Stand by. Over.
Bulldog Leader standing by, Communicator One. Reading Lima, Romeo, Foxtrot, Nina. Over.
Emma Shaw switched her ship-to-ship into limited range frequency 9.
Bulldog Leader, negative all base electrical systems are out. I say again, negative. All systems, including long-range scanning, approximately 85% operational. All additional fighter aircraft have been ordered away to regroup. Cargo lifters more than 95% incapacitated. Impossible to evacuate base at this time. Do you copy, Bulldog Leader? Over.
Roger that, Communicator One. Both squadrons under my command are flying on vapor only. Do you copy, Communicator One? Over.
Affirmative, Bulldog Leader. Your fuel consumption rates have been calculated. Aerial refueling impossible under impending combat conditions. Minimum 36 bogeys visible on long-range scanning. ETA 7 minutes 43 seconds. Do you copy? Over.
Roger, Communicator One. We do not have enough fuel to engage or flee. Over.
Roger that, Bulldog Leader. You are instructed to order down Bulldog Pup's lowest on reserve fuel tanks while balance of your two squadrons maintain defensive posture. As soon as refueling is accomplished, the remainder of your squadrons are to land and refuel. Any problems with that, Commander Shaw? Over.
We'll go, Communicator One. Beginning compliance now. Bulldog Leader out.
Good luck, Commander. Communicator One out.
Emma Shaw switched away from LRF-9 to regular ship-to-ship.
Bulldog Pups, this is Bulldog Leader.
Emma ordered down to hard deck for refueling those aircraft within her squadrons which were lowest on reserve fuel, assigning the remaining aircraft to stay on her wings in modified defense formation, then designating priorities for those aircraft to refuel in turn.
Any questions? Over.
There were none, just the way she liked it. There would not be time enough for all aircraft in her two squadrons to refuel and get airborne again before the arrival of the enemy fighter aircraft. Emma Shaw knew that. 6 minutes and 45 seconds remained before the 36 bogeys would be in combat range. Their longer-range weapons could already have been fired against ground-based targets, would soon be in range to acquire preliminary fixes on airborne targets. Emma Shaw estimated that fewer than 2 minutes of aerial combat would drain her tanks dry, and if she were lucky, she'd drop like a stone and die in the crash, as opposed to getting blown out of the sky. That was the kind of luck she did not need. Paul Rubinstein was not given to doodling, but as he stood before the imposing shape of the mountain summit, he drew in the snow. With the toe of his boot, the mushroom-shaped cloud, characteristic of a thermonuclear detonation. Mankind was, he was now firmly convinced, incapable of learning from past mistakes. The best scientific minds in both the Transglobal Alliance and the enemy camp, Eden and her Nazi allies, freely admitted that even one nuclear blast might bring about the destruction of the atmosphere, obliterating all human and animal life, as was almost the case 625 years ago when all this began. He was an accidental survivor. That's how Paul Rubinstein had always viewed himself. Although he was born and raised an Air Force brat, he never had any martial training of any sort until after falling in with John Rourke in the aftermath of the night of the war. He'd volunteered to march across the desert with this strangely commanding man he'd met among the complement of passengers, stayed with him, learned from him, became very proficient at the ways of warfare simply out of the demands of survival. As a child, it was somehow implicit that all superheroes, outside of men like Moses and Joshua, were Christian. But that had never bothered him, because he had no aspirations to go about the world righting wrongs with anything more violent than a passion for right and contempt for prejudice. Nor did Paul Rubinstein consider himself at all heroic now, albeit that he fit the mold not at all. He was tall enough, but never more than slightly built, and from childhood up until his awakening from the sleep that first time, he had always needed glasses. He merely did what he had to do in order to keep himself on good terms with his conscience and to keep himself and his friends alive. John, on the other hand, was the hero through and through. Unlike many so-called heroes, however, John's heroism was intrinsic to John's being. John Rourke could be nothing else, and heroism became him well. After all the fighting, all the killing, all the struggles, mankind was once again brought to the brink of total annihilation by stupidity and greed. John liked to look at the stars. Paul Rubinstein felt that if anyone looked at the stars right now, it would be likely the stars could be seen laughing back at the suicidal folly below. Michael Rourke had nothing to do but clean and check his weapons, which he did, field stripping the last of the two Beretta 92F 9mm, which he carried. Removing the magazine, then clearing the chamber, he let the slide move forward, depressing the disassembly latch, swinging it downward, then pulling slide and barrel forward off the frame. He set to work on the interior diameter of the bore with a soaked patch. Now that he had asked Natalia to marry him, and Natalia had accepted, his question and her response were implicit between them for some time, he had to consider the future, if there was one. Either one of two things would occur as a result of two distinct chains of events, neither of which he could predict. Human life would either be obliterated, or there would be peace, at least of a sort. In the case of the former possibility, there would be no future about which to worry. If, however, the nuclear detonation which had already occurred did not in and of itself signal man's doom, nor precipitate increased nuclear combat which would, this war at least would eventually end. Michael Rourke doubted not for a moment that if the war ended, the side of the angels would somehow come out victorious. The Transglobal Alliance, if for no other reason than the fact that it stood opposed to neo-Nazism, was definitely the side of the angels. As his father, John Rourke, had once said,
"The good guy always wins. It may seem as though evil is victorious at times, but in the end, evil will always fail, and right will eventually prevail. Such a victory might take longer to be achieved than any of us will ever live to see, than any of us might even imagine. But in the final analysis, there can be no other way."
A bit optimistic, perhaps, but without such optimism, there would be no reason beyond sheer stubbornness to do anything other than give up. Aside from the war itself, there was the nagging issue of Dr. Thorn Rolvag's discoveries concerning the suboceanic rift. The planet might already be doomed by a volcanic anomaly. So if mankind were not wiped clean from the face of the earth, there would be details to which he must attend. Making a home, supporting his wife, finding something productive to do with his life, making the world a better place for the children whom he and Natalia would bring into that world together. Somehow, the thought of normalcy was unnerving to him. He had never lived in a time of peace. Even before the night of the war, there was the constant saber-rattling of the two superpowers, something about which not even a small child, as he had been, could remain wholly ignorant. Barely to the age of understanding, his sister, 2 years younger still, the night of the war came, and in the morning of its aftermath, he killed for the first time, plunging a boning knife into the kidney of a man who was about to sexually assault his mother. Not long after that, he'd killed again in defense of what was right. It was not, thank God, exactly habit, but it was something to which he had become at least somewhat accustomed. Michael Rourke supposed that he was fortunate, born without the sort of liberal excuse for a conscience which would have totally traumatized him. His conscience was not an excuse, but the real thing. From what he'd seen in videos, read in books, heard related by his father, and faintly recalled from his own memories of the time before the night of the war, it was fashionable in some quarters to believe that violence of any sort, even in defense of human life, was somehow intrinsically evil. If, however, a man or woman stepped so far outside the human community as to rob another human being of his life or dignity, killing that man or woman was, however regrettable, not something of great moral import, considered in full context. What was of moral import, and cause for great sadness and soul-searching, was the fact that a human being could sink to such a level that he or she had to be destroyed because he or she was no longer truly human, only preyed on the human community while pretending to be a part of it. Michael Rourke's father had told him once when they were alone in the retreat, Annie already asleep for the night,
"Had the night of the war never come, Michael, it's sad to say that the eventual outcome for humanity might have been a little different. The economy of the United States, like the economies of other nations, was already severely strained. The possible solutions to ecological concerns, such as the depletion of the ozone layer, global warming, overpopulation, were staggering even to consider. We've talked about the issue of global warming before, son. Did you ever consider what might have happened, say, if there had never been the night of the war and the scientists who predicted global warming had turned out to be right?
Oh, I don't know, Dad. I mean, it would have been hotter everywhere, and that would have meant farming problems and stuff like that, and the oceans rising.
Right. Take the ocean level rise. Considering only the economic consequences of that one potential result of the global warming hypothesis, should it have come to pass. Now, according to some computer models at the time, a significant rise in global temperature would have raised ocean levels by melting of the ice caps in some glaciers, to a point where much of the eastern seaboard of the United States, not to mention other places, would have been flooded. Now, consider New York City, all right? Before its destruction during the night of the war, it was the most heavily populated city in the United States. It was the financial capital of the Western world, perhaps of the entire world. Innumerable businesses were run from New York City. Financial decisions made there would shape the future of mankind. Now, how much do you think it would have cost to move New York City? Either that, or build a seawall around it and all down the rest of the East Coast to save all the other important cities.
I don't know, Dad.
Trouble was, son, if anybody did know, nobody was telling. And that was just one of the problems facing humanity. There were diseases, there was poverty, there was international aggression. The catalog was almost endless. And fewer people wanted to be bothered by the problems. It was better to bury oneself in self-indulgence, shut the mind away in ephemeral pleasures, and just wait for the inevitable cataclysm. In some ways, Michael, the last half of the 20th century was an era of renewed involvement, but only by a comparatively small segment of the population. Some people, out of ignorance or greed, aligned themselves with causes which were deleterious to mankind's welfare. There were those who supported the abrogation of their own civil liberties and their possible subjugation into serfdom by fighting for the destruction of the Second Amendment. There were others whose translation of a genuine concern for the welfare of animals led them to destroy or interfere with medical research which could have saved human lives. Still, others were so narrow-minded in their own religious beliefs and so convinced that their conception of morality was the only correct conception that they fought to have government codify religion and dictate every aspect of human existence, totally denying freedom of choice and individual moral responsibility. But at least, however benighted, self-destructive, or dumb, okay? At least they were doing something. even if it was stupid. And there were many more people who worked with remarkable diligence and true service to mankind, helping to solve problems rather than make more problems, fighting to alleviate suffering, working to spread freedom of choice. But those who chose to be involved, for good or for bad, were the minority, as opposed to the vast majority of people who did nothing at all except kick back. And the minority who worked diligently to inform, to educate, to uplift their fellow man and try to enhance human dignity were numerically overwhelmed. But they kept trying in the face of incalculable odds. So, in a way, Michael, it all might have ended anyway. To paraphrase T.S. Eliot, mankind just went out with a bang rather than a whimper. But in either case, the result might just as well have been the same.
Perhaps, Michael Rourke thought, his hands moving as if with a will of their own as he reassembled his pistol, mankind had a death wish. And however the events in which he and his family were embroiled were to turn out, the ultimate destiny of mankind was indelibly written in the fabric of time. The inevitable destruction of all by the many, despite the valor and compassion of the few. The bullet wound across his left tricep was deep, but Tim Shaw had been able to stanch the bleeding. His right arm, which had numbed as if broken when the Nazi's knife had cut him, pained him greatly, but not counting the discomfort, the limb was fully functional. He sat in the little clearing in the high mountain woods beside the already livid body of the man who had tried to kill him. But he didn't ponder the Nazi's death. What was done, and in this case, of terrific advantage. Instead, he considered his own problems. The loss of blood from his wounds, especially the gunshot, was severe enough to drastically limit his strength and endurance. When he'd first hit the ground from the tree, he'd thought he'd broken his back. Evidently, he had not, but he was sore beyond belief and might have suffered some serious damage. Every time he moved, Tim Shaw was in pain. There was always the hope that his son Eddie hadn't paid any attention to him and even now had the Honolulu SWAT team combing the mountains for him. But that was a slim chance indeed. And because of his own stubbornness, he had no means of radio communication. This fight with the Nazi saboteur who was behind the bloodbath at Sebastian's Reef Country Day School and so dedicated to mayhem and murder was to have been mano a mano. It had been that. The Nazi was dead, but Tim Shaw didn't survive the encounter in exactly perfect shape. With considerable difficulty, Shaw stood up. He looked down at the dead man by his feet.
Hope the worms don't get sick on you, pal.
It would be slow, but he told himself he'd make it. Thorn Rolvag's eyes scanned beyond the hastily erected coastal defense battery and out to sea. Kilauea was still erupting, but the eruptions beneath the sea were what concerned him. The volcanic vent was widening in an easterly direction, taking it toward the North American plate. Although no computer model could predict with exact certainty what would happen then, Rolvag was convinced that the odds lay in favor of the vent splitting, going in both directions along the boundary of the plate, slicing through the so-called Ring of Fire, the volcanoes surrounding the Pacific Basin, and precipitating a chain of volcanic eruptions which would be of biblical proportions. It would almost certainly mean the end of the world. It would mean the death of his wife, his children, the destruction of everyone and everything which he held dear. And there was only one slim chance that the relentless, inexorable expansion of the vent could be halted. For that, he would need to utilize nuclear energy in a way which had not been discussed since the dawn of the nuclear age almost 700 years ago. In those days, propaganda had stressed the peaceful uses of atomic energy. And indeed, there were many possibilities, few of them used except in medicine and in the generation of primitive fission-based electrical power. But at the time, the bomb was touted as a means by which harbors could be cut with almost surgical precision, the face of the land altered at a fraction of the cost, time, or labor involved with more conventional means. That potential was never realized. Yet if the Earth were to be saved, that potential would have to be harnessed. He could vent the volcanic energy a little bit at a time. He could wall up the rift, diverting it gradually by degrees. He could save the planet from destruction. Maybe. But there would be no chance at all without virtually every nuclear weapon available in the current world arsenal. Unlike the days before the night of the war, when thousands of nuclear warheads existed in the arsenals of both superpowers, when 2,000 nuclear warheads alone could have been found on the eastern coast of what was then the United States along the Savannah River, there were comparatively few today. Best intelligence estimates allowed Dietrich Zimmer's Nazi forces and the forces of Eden a combined total slightly in excess of 500 warheads. The vast majority of these, however, were low-yield, comparatively clean tactical devices, battlefield weapons, ideal for Rovog's purposes. New Germany possessed somewhere around 100, almost all tactical. The present-day United States, which largely consisted of Midway and Hawaii, had approximately 200, and of these, more than 80% submarine-launched ballistic missiles within the tactical power range. The only intercontinental ballistic missiles in the U.S. inventory were antiques, converted from captured enemy stockpiles, the vast majority of which had been destroyed under controlled conditions. No one power, not even the United States and New Germany combined, the only two nuclear powers within the Transglobal Alliance, possessed sufficient nuclear warheads to get the job done. The larger weapons in each nation's inventory would be useless, and there was no time to build or convert what he needed. Without the full cooperation of Eden and her Nazi allies, there would not be sufficient battlefield power warheads to stop the volcanic vent from growing, from destroying the planet. Thorn Rolvag looked out to sea, powerless unless a miracle were to take place. Over the course of time, there were many secrets hidden in the Himalayas. More than half a millennia ago, some scientific researchers had felt that a possible missing link between man and his simian ancestors might be found surviving in the icy Himalayan vastness. If a Yeti ever existed, or did still, Dietrich Zimmer truly didn't care. His secret was more important. It was here, in the Himalayas, that his most secret and most impregnable fortress lay, its entrances and defenses known to only a trusted few, its location known only to those who had built it and supplied it. He sat at his desk, his son Martin before him.
Why can't we release the clones?
For a very simple reason. Physically identical duplicates of John Rook and his family would be of no use whatsoever without proper programming and mental conditioning. Sarah Rook, your mother, was available to us, as was Wolfgang Mann. Your natural father, John Rook, your brother and sister, Michael and Annie, and the Jew, Rubinstein, and the Russian woman, Major T.M. Morovna, have not been available to us. Since we have not recorded them, their clones are useless to us. You must have patience. As was once said, all things come to him who waits. That is not a bad piece of advice. Our plans progress quite well, and I did not even have to use my own clone.
It had been a near thing, his pilot barely able to land the command aircraft before falling over at the plane's controls.
You used one nuclear weapon. Why not hit hard and fast right now?
Because, Martin, I want the Transglobal Alliance to do what I want it to do, not to vanish from the face of the Earth. That is the entire purpose of my plan, and you know that.
What are we going to do with the remains?
Ah, yes, the remains. We are searching for viable cells even as we speak. They should be obtainable. Then, you will be quite pleased. Sit down, relax. All is well.
John Rourke had planned ahead. When he and the family first left Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, to rendezvous with Dietrich Zimmer in what devolved into an abortive attempt to make an exchange for Sarah Rourke, John Rourke anticipated a wide variety of contingencies and planned accordingly for them. One of those was that he would somehow wind up weaponless. In light of that, he had visited the Lancer showroom just prior to leaving the islands, one of the purposes behind that visit to purchase, but the management would not charge him, insisted on gifting him with the items instead, two of Lancer's superlative duplicates of the Sig Sauer P-228. Natalia already had one of their 226s, and it was faultless to the last detail, identical to the original. Although never a great fan of the 9mm Parabellum cartridge, as compared to the 45 ACP, from an objective basis, he knew the ballistic performance was, if the gun were properly loaded, nearly identical between the calibers. From Lancers, Rourke additionally secured a supply of 13 and 20-round magazines, plus a substantial stock of Lancer's equally excellent duplication of the only 9mm Parabellum load he'd ever really liked, the Federal 9BP 115 grain jacketed hollow point. At the corporate range in the basement of the facility, Rourke ran 200 rounds through each pistol, testing the spare magazines as well. As he had come to expect from Lancer replications, just as he would have expected from the original guns manufactured over six centuries ago, performance was flawless. To accompany the pistols, he secured another of Lancer's duplications, this a double-rig copy of the special-purpose shoulder holster designed exclusively for the 228 pistols by the designer of the tri-speed adjustable shoulder holsters. Made of waterproof black ballistic nylon and lined with waterproof black doeskin suede, the holsters were fully ambidextrous and could be dismounted from the shoulder harness to be worn fully concealed on the belt if desired. Acquiring two double magazine pouches as well as packing the rest of the magazines in a black musette bag, if he lived, he would lend the Lancer people one of his Milt Spark six-pack magazine carriers to duplicate. He handed over the guns, the holsters, the magazines, and a supply of extra ammunition to Commander Washington, asking the SEAL team leader to bring them along for him, just in case. The pitons, which Wolverton had crafted for them, seemed serviceable enough, if only the metal from which they were formed had not become brittle. He'd know when he reached the rock face if they had. Natalia's expropriated Nazi gunship was ready to go airborne, Annie with her. Michael and Paul flanked John Rourke now as he approached the face they had chosen to climb. Commander Washington was in charge on the ground. Two of his SEAL team personnel, Moore and Jones, along with one of the German long-range mountain patrol commandos, Schmidt, along as well for the climb to the summit. Rourke was free of armament save for the pistols he wore, six semi-autos with the little SMW-38 special revolver and his now customary three knives. Paul had his German MP-40 submachine gun slung tight to his side, his two Browning high powers in their usual carries. Michael had his two shoulder-holstered Berettas and his 4-inch barrel SMW-44 Magnum revolver, a bullpup-stocked energy rifle, slung at his side.
Assuming all goes well and we reach the summit, it's almost certain that we'll be instantly detected. If for some reason we're not, then so much the better, of course. We should remember that the men topside are Nazis, and we should remember it well, because our mission is to kill as many of them as possible as quickly as we can. The more their equipment which remains intact, the better off we are. And we don't want any of their helicopters getting away either. Are there any questions?
Begging the General's pardon, sir, but how many of them do you think are up there?
Well, there are six of us, Jones, and that should be sufficient. Suit up, gentlemen.
They would take the ropes in moments, as soon as Natalia signaled she was ready. Rourke shoved back his hood and started pulling the black toque over his head. Natalia Tyomarovna gave one last look toward the gauges on her panel. Then she looked through the helicopter's bubble toward the mountain's base. Annie was sitting beside her.
They'll be all right.
We love all three of them, don't we?
They know it.
Natalia only nodded. John, Michael, and Paul, along with the three volunteers from Commander Washington's force, waited, ready to move. The six men were stripped of their Arctic parkas, attired in black combat boots, black BDU pants, black sweaters, and black hoods. These latter with a window at the center of the eyes, but the eyes covered with snow goggles. They looked like they should be freezing, but to a man, they would be wearing thermal gear beneath their outer clothes.
Are you ready to signal them?
No, but I suppose that I have to.
Natalia turned the cabin lights on and off three times. There was an answering series of flashes from one of the six men at the base of the mountain. Then, within seconds, they started to climb. Paul Rubinstein wrapped his fists around the rope and started with his right foot against the rock surface. Perhaps 100 yards above him, John Rourke and the German commando Schmidt, who was also an experienced climber, had let down two ropes, so he, Michael, and the two SEAL team men, Moore and Jones, could follow. By the time they reached the location of the first tie-off, John and Schmidt would be well along toward the next level, perhaps already have attained it. Rourke's left foot was levered into a niche of rock, the rock coated with slick ice, as was the rope Rourke trailed behind him. His right foot perched on one of the improvised pitons, Rourke reached up, another of the pitons in his left hand, a heavy-headed hammer, not a proper climber's hammer, but a substantially sized claw hammer from the machine shop, in his right. The piton was in as deep as it would go. Slipping the hammer into an improvised loop on his pistol belt, then locking it in place with a hook and pile strip, Rourke took solid hold of the piton and tugged. It held, at least so far. Playing his body weight between the crack in the rock surface and the piton on which his booted right foot rested, he simultaneously pulled with his arm and pushed with his leg. Because of the uncertainty of the equipment, the horrendous visibility, and his unfamiliarity with the rock surface, he was taking the climb in a slow, painstaking way, relying as little as possible on the rock face, as much as possible on the pitons. Standing to his full height now, his safety line looped into the last piton he'd driven, Rourke reached to maximum comfortable extension, retrieved his hammer, and began to stake another piton into the living rock. He looked to his left for Schmidt. The German commando was perhaps 50 feet below him, but apparently doing well. Rourke eyeballed a likely spot for his next piton, then retrieved his hammer. He would repeat the process until he reached the next likely place to pause and was nearly out of pitons. As Paul, Michael, Moore, and Jones followed, they would extract the pitons Rourke and Schmidt had left behind, then secure them into the rope so that Rourke and Schmidt could haul them up and begin again. There were those who contended that men and women who involved themselves in dangerous activities knew no fear. Perhaps that was true, but Rourke doubted so. When there was time for it, the men and women he'd known before the night of the war and since, who had displayed conspicuous courage in times of great danger, had all known fear as well. Fear was a normal human response. Those who had to go on in spite of fear merely became skilled at conquering it. John Thomas Rourke did not know how skilled or unskilled he might be in that regard, but the cold feeling in the pit of his stomach was something he had known before, and if he lived, he would know again. Fear. He went on, clambering along the ice-slicked rock face, the wind howling, strong now, vision obscured by the swirling of the snow. The only way that he would know he had reached the steeply angled summit would be by the orientation of his body to the ground. The only plus to the miserable weather conditions was that the enemy would be less able to detect the assault visually. Electronic sensing equipment was another matter, however. At what he gauged as perhaps 100 yards below the angled summit, Rourke found a rock chimney. He knew its location from previous reconnaissance of the mountain face, and discovering it less than a yard above him now meant that he was indeed close to the summit. But he was also a good 100 feet to the north of his originally planned route. There were two choices now confronting him. He could rope his way laterally, back 100 feet or so, and thus return to the planned route, or he could climb the chimney. Schmidt was still well below him, the other climbers, Paul and the two SEAL team men, Moore and Jones, further below still. Everyone else would have to rope back too, and that, under the circumstances, both atmospheric and topographic, could be insanely dangerous. If they came up through the chimney, the burden for the men below him would be easier and, of considerable importance under the deteriorating conditions, protect them from the elements. But the climb for him would be tougher in one respect, as he automatically squinted against the driving sleet and snow in order to view the chimney through his goggles now. Despite their protection, he could see that the chimney surface was glass slick from ice. If he used the methodology he had employed so far successfully, however tediously, in the earlier portion of the climb, attacking the chimney would mean leaving the men exposed, unmoving, possible sniper bait, and certainly at the mercy of the elements. If he climbed in the accepted fashion, he would save time, but dramatically increase his own chances for disaster. He could barely see the four men below Schmidt, Schmidt spiderwebbing his way upward a piton at a time. Rourke made his decision. He started snaking down a rope to Schmidt. Icing conditions were worsening rapidly.
Will you be able to take off in this?
I don't know, Annie. But I'm not going to wait until the last minute to find out.
Vicious crosswinds assaulted the open ground before the mouth of the entrance into the mountain. Natalia felt genuine sympathy for the men of Commander Washington's force who had to endure the wind unprotected. Visibility was obscenely bad. Before she went airborne, Natalia fully intended to construct some ruse by means of which she could entice Annie out of the helicopter. There was no sense in both of them risking their lives in the assault on the mountain summit. In a worst-case scenario, Michael and Paul and John would be killed as well, which would mean that Sarah's family would all be taken from her. That would be too much to ask any person to endure if it could be avoided.
Monitor the icing for me, will you? I want to check my gear just in case we have to ditch.
Sure thing!
Natalia looked to her weapons. Her customary twin stainless 4-inch L-frame Smiths 686s with American Eagles on the barrel flats were holstered in the double-flap rig, which rode just below her natural waist. The Balisong knife, rather than pouched in the leg of her jumpsuit along her left thigh, was in the pocket of her parka. Her left leg was moving better, and if circumstances forced her to, she could move reasonably normally on it. The German painkiller was doing its work well. In addition to the revolvers, beneath her open parka was the Ken Null shoulder holster with the suppressor-fitted Walther PPKS. She had one other handgun with her, a Lancer copy of the Sig Sauer P226 9mm. This rested on the map console beside her, but would be shoved between her pistol belt and her abdomen once she was airborne. Natalia looked over Annie's shoulder. The de-icing system, at least according to the panel readouts, was performing as it should. The true test lay in the flying, which would begin shortly enough. The sole of John Rourke's left boot slipped, and he started down the chimney, hands groping for a hold. He thrust his right foot outward and locked his leg and caught himself. Rourke assessed his body for damage, not finding any readily apparent. He opened his eyes once again, then looked up. Some 50 yards of the rock chimney still needed to be traversed, counting the yardage he'd lost when he slipped. He paused, wedging himself more securely, then finding a piton. He took the hammer from the improvised loop at his pistol belt and slightly altered his position. There was the temptation to work his way upward the rest of the way by using pitons, but he was at least out of the killing wind. Paul, Michael, and the others were not. Rourke started up once again, wedging himself, then pushing, then wedging again. When he judged he had gone another 5 yards, he stopped, anchored another piton, then roped into it. Insurance again. And again, he began to climb. Once he reached the top, he would let down rope, and the others could climb along the rope after him, joining him at the slope before the summit. Once the first of the five were up the chimney, Rourke would set to driving pitons along the slope and webbing rope, but as silently and unobtrusively as he could. He would be in sight of the enemy if they cared to look. The matter of electronic countermeasures was something for which he could not compensate. Why timing would be critical with Natalia's chopper flight. But there was a fact which he had to face, that Natalia might not be able to get airborne in these terrible winds and visibility. If she could not get airborne and launch the explosives-laden remote video probe she had aboard, there would be no distraction to mask the last phase of the assault, and the fight would be there on the slick sloping granite above the cliff face. The thought made John Rourke even colder. Rourke kept climbing, glancing above and through the swirling snow and into the impenetrable darkness. There was a chance that the climb had already been detected, that the Nazi commandos in position on the summit were merely waiting to strike. He could not dismiss that thought, try as he might. Rourke just kept climbing. 36 Eden fighter aircraft closed from the west on the crippled base as Emma Shaw, her engines near to flame out, had been forced to land. The refueling process seemed to be taking an eternity, but while it was in progress, her V-stall was being fitted with additional forward missile pods on both wings. The added weight would slow her down, but only for a little while. She would lose the missiles quickly enough.
Ready, Commander!
Her canopy was already closing as Emma Shaw returned the thumbs-up signal and started taxiing for the field. The sky overhead was filled with explosions, missile and aircraft streaking everywhere. Her own two squadrons and the enemy aircraft at times nearly colliding, it seemed, as she observed. The darkness with the heavy overcast made things worse. Despite the electronics with which her aircraft was equipped, she was the kind of pilot who preferred to actually fly, not ride. At last, she turned into the nearest runway. There were no tower orders to worry about. Emma reminded herself that she was used to taking off from carriers, whether on the surface or beneath it, and that runway distances here on land were a luxury. To have made a vertical takeoff under combat conditions would have been suicidal, leaving herself crippled for precious seconds.
Oh, shit. Here we go.
Two enemy fighters were zeroing in toward her from the far side of the field. One of her own squadron was on their tails, but Emma Shaw could not help. Or could she?
Let's pretend this is a carrier. This is Bulldog Leader, Bulldog Pops. Mama's coming back home to get those nasty bullies. Cover me.
Her own squadron member launched a forward-firing missile, catching one of the two enemy aircraft in the starboard wing. Emma Shaw pulled up hard on the yoke, her aircraft's nose rising just enough to make her airborne in a steep climb from the tarmac. She banked, flattening out, streaking over the wrecked enemy aircraft, joining the pursuit of the second Eden fighter.
Time to lighten up.
Emma launched a portside forward-firing missile. The enemy aircraft vaporized, and Emma Shaw hauled back on the yoke, starting to climb into the darkness. Annie Rubinstein was worried about Natalia's leg because Natalia had asked for more pain medication. The drug's effect should have held on for at least another few hours, Annie thought. Bundled to the nth degree against the cold, face swathed in scarves and hood wrapped tightly around her head, Annie stepped out of the chopper and into the night, instantly chilled to the bone despite the layers of clothing she wore. She wedged her body against the wind, bending into it as she walked toward the entrance to the mountain fortress that had been Dietrich Zimmer's. Suddenly, Annie got a flash as to why Natalia had sent her to get the pain medication. She turned around. The helicopter was automatically releasing the guy lines which had anchored it against the wind. Rotor speed, which had been minimal a few seconds before, was increasing.
Natalia!
But the helicopter was already beginning to rise out of the snow, buffeted crazily by the winds. Natalia obviously fighting to keep control. The machine lurching, slipping, rising, then slipping laterally again.
Natalia! Don't!
Annie started running back toward the aircraft, knowing that it was useless.
You can't do this alone, Natalia!
Her friend, soon to be her sister-in-law, was suddenly lost in the blackness above. John Rourke rolled over onto his back, caution be damned, happy for an instant to be out of the chimney. He snatched one of the twin stainless Teutonic Scoremasters from its holster at his hip. He lay on the slope. The ice was thick and slick here. Had he tried to stand, the action would have been hopeless. As his eyes scanned as far as he could see through the darkness and the swirling snow, he spied no enemy personnel. Far in the distance, there were several light sources. He presumed these were the enemy aircraft, or perhaps the landing pad control facilities. Reholstering his pistol, Rourke twisted himself around, taking from the musette bag at his side the last remaining pitons, grabbing for the hammer as he glanced once over his shoulder, then beginning to drive the pitons into the living granite. He set a triangularly shaped pattern, where the weight which would be on the rope would be shared relatively evenly by the pitons, rather than only on the one bearing the bulk of the tension. Rourke secured his rope, weighted it to the last piton, then began snaking it down through the chimney. Merely to have dropped it would invite the rope to snag in the rocks or one of the pitons he had set into the chimney's face along the way. Several times he was forced to coil upward, then re-release the rope. But at last, after he had let out the entire length, he felt a previously determined series of tugs, indicating that someone had the rope and was ready to use it. Rourke wedged himself as best he could, looking over his shoulder again. Should he be discovered whilst aiding the next climber, there would be nothing that he could do. If he let go of the rope, there would be a substantial chance that the pitons alone might not hold. He tugged back in code on his end of the rope, then felt the rope go taut under his hands. Someone was on the way up. Annie pushed the scarves away from her face as she touched Commander Washington's shoulder.
Yes, Mrs. Rubenstein.
You're going up, toward the summit from the inside, correct?
Yes, ma'am. Most of my people are already in position. As you know, enemy personnel are suspected of holding the top two floors. We intend to do something about that. And it might also assist your father and husband and brother up there on the summit. I have Major Tiemirovna's helicopter under observation. As soon as she moves in, meaning that she'll have gotten the flare signal from your father's team, we move in.
I'm going with you.
But, Mrs. Rubenstein, if your father or your husband...
They'd approve. I'm going with you.
Yes, ma'am.
Emma Shaw barrel-rolled the V-stall to port, two Eden fighters streaking past her, following the contrails of their missiles. As she pulled out of the roll, she brought her fighters' engines to full power, climbing after the enemy aircraft. The two pods of additional missiles she carried were fired out, their racks jettisoned. She was lighter, faster, but almost out of missiles, too. Leveling out, her eyes alternated between the electronic heads-up on her canopy windscreen and the darkness surrounding her. At 3 o'clock, she saw one of the two aircraft she'd followed, its prop wash glowing against the night. Heads-up was signaling her that her aircraft had been acquired by an enemy heatseeker. Emma Shaw smiled, in that same instant spying the second aircraft. She banked hard to port, half-rolled, dove, the heatseeker on her tail, her nose aimed toward the second enemy aircraft. The second enemy aircraft was going into evasive maneuvers that Emma Shaw had seen before. She anticipated their result, banking hard to port, throttling back, then dropping her landing gear as she leveled off. Airspeed and altitude began dropping almost instantly as she skipped over the air. She was tight over the second enemy aircraft. The heatseeker would contact in 13 seconds, according to the computer. The second enemy aircraft was picking up speed. Emma Shaw retracted her landing gear as she increased speed, matching the second enemy aircraft, dangerously close to it. 4 seconds until impact from the heatseeker. 3. Emma Shaw throttled back almost to stall speed, dropping landing gear once more. Neither the enemy aircraft just below her nor the heatseeker having time to change course.
Yo, Bulldog Leader, great one, Emma.
This is Bulldog Leader, Bulldog Pups. Keep killing those bad guys. Bulldog Leader, out.
Paul Rubenstein's hands ached, but he grasped the last of his pitons in his left fist, the hammer in his right, then spiked the piton into the granite. As Paul Rubenstein roped on, he tried spotting John on the far side of the slope, but the darkness and the swirling snow made that impossible. When he'd at last gotten to the height of the chimney to take over for John on the rope for the next climber, John told him,
"Give it 10 minutes from now, then fire the flare pistol for Natalia."
Paul Rubenstein looked now at the face of his wristwatch. He judged that some 2 minutes remained. He leaned back, unlimbering his submachine gun. His position was approximately 100 yards away from the perimeter of the mountaintop landing pad, the nearest enemy personnel perhaps that close, perhaps even closer. By now, Michael, Jones, Moore, and Schmidt would be on the slope, starting to work their way out along the ropes that he and John had laid, readying themselves for the assault. Paul Rubenstein estimated that he had perhaps 50 yards of crawling to do, unaided by a safety line, before he'd be able to stand upright, then attack. Once he fired the flare, he would begin the crawl, as would the others. By the time they had reached the point where, theoretically, it would be possible for them to stand and fight, Natalia should be in position, her explosive-laden remote video probes launched and zigzagging their way over the enemy position, hopefully diverting attention from the first few seconds of the assault, which would be the most dangerous. 1 minute remained. Natalia's eyes were fixed on the mountaintop, the Nazi helicopter hovering some 2 miles off. She glanced at the Rolex on her left wrist, previously synchronized with John's watch and the watches of the other men. Once the flare was fired, which would be at any time now, she would have 1 minute to get the helicopter gunship into position and activate the remote probes. It would take that long, John had judged, for the men to scramble over the remaining portion of the summit slope and get themselves into position. The flare which would be fired would, of course, alert the enemy defenders that something was about to happen, but if she stayed to the schedule, there would be virtually no time for reaction. She returned her full attention to the summit, although she had not once fully let her eyes leave it, and the gunship's sensing equipment was preset to alarm her when the flare fired. She would rather trust her own senses than something mechanical. And then she saw it, so faint that had she not anticipated the flare being fired, she might never have noticed it. Natalia started her machine toward the summit, arming the remote video probes in the same instant, then arming her weapons systems. If one of the Nazi helicopter gunships, which remained on the summit, were to get airborne, her job would be to prevent it from getting away, regardless of what that required of her. John Rourke was moving on knees and elbows, a Detonic Scoremaster in each hand, the guns beginning to coat with ice from the instant he drew them from the full flap holsters at his sides. He was counting seconds. Natalia would be prompt, and the moment the first of the remote probes was launched, John Rourke wanted to be in position, because each second he delayed was a second more, allowing the Nazi defenders here at the mountain summit to realize that the probes were a diversion. Lights were visible from the control station for the mountaintop helipad, as were running lights from the helicopters. 4 of these, he judged. That would be enough to get Commander Washington's entire force away from the mountain if none of the machines were too severely damaged, and if there were someplace left to go. The stupidity, the arrogance, the calculated viciousness of Dietrich Zimmer's utilizing a battlefield nuclear weapon was beyond comprehension. A few such detonations and the precarious atmospheric envelope, which had been steadily returning since the Great Conflagration, when the atmosphere ionized and burned, might again be destroyed. 42 seconds had passed since Paul fired the flare. Natalia would be 3/4 of the way to her position, her remote probes ready to launch. The ground was more level here, and Rourke risked moving more rapidly. He was within 20 yards of the helipad, the nearest of the Nazi machines some 10 yards beyond that. Nazi personnel were not so far in evidence, but he could still only discern lights, not anything in greater detail because of the darkness and the snow. As he neared, he started to move more cautiously. Ice creepers lashed to the soles of his boots. Paul and Michael wore sets of creepers as well, and the other 3 men wore improvised versions of the same thing. It was one of the curiosities of this new age that with all the added ice and snow coverage because of drastically reduced global temperatures as a result of the thinning of the atmosphere and the subsequent escape of heat into the blackness of space, no one manufactured ice creepers. He had been introduced to them by his old friend Jerry Bjergel years before the night of the war. Often they had proved invaluable, providing steady footing under otherwise intolerably slick conditions. Had John Rourke been possessed of any entrepreneurial inclinations, a business opportunity of rare potential would have awaited him, assuming, of course, that the entire planet would not be destroyed as a result of Dietrich Zimmer's unconscionable use of nuclear weapons. But because of Dietrich Zimmer's insane ambitions, there were other matters more pressing for John Rourke's mind to ponder at the moment. The video probes, which Natalia had launched, glided overhead toward the Nazi gunships. It would only be a matter of seconds before the reaction started. It was better not to wait. He was within 10 yards of the rear wall of the control building for the helipad. It was logical to assume that many of the Nazi commandos would be huddled inside it against the storm, while only a few unlucky souls waited in the cold and wind. John Rourke holstered his pistols, securing the flaps more as a retention device than as protection, the guns already ice-coated. Instead, he drew the Crane LSX knife, its 12-inch blade worked to a near-razor hone. Rourke quickened his pace, eyes scanning the night for some sign of human activity, and he found it. Still standing, but huddled along the north wall of the building in the full force of the wind, was a sentry. He closed fast and snapped the man's head back. Rourke dragged him back around the corner, quickly wiping the blade clean on the fellow's Arctic gear, then resheathing. Under more relaxed circumstances, Rourke would have made a quick search for papers of potential intelligence value and disabled the weapons he was leaving behind. There was, however, time for neither. Rourke stood, reaching to his sides for the scoremasters. He reached the far side of the building. There was already movement, men running from their machines, sentries appearing from hiding places taken against the elements, the video probes doing their work. Rourke glanced around the corner of the building, seeing the main entrance. He turned the corner, approaching the entrance, then taking the kickboardless steps two at a time. There was a small porch at their height, and Rourke stopped there. He turned his right hand on the knob. The door flew open with the pressure of the wind. John Rourke stepped through the door. There was a radio man seated on the far side of the room. Another man, on the left side of the single large room, was securing the hood of his parka. Another man was on the right. Rourke leveled both pistols toward a man courageously charging at him with only a folding camp chair as a weapon. As he worked his way counterclockwise into the room and away from the door, Rourke thrust the pistol, slide-locked back over the empty magazine into his pistol belt, in the same motion sweeping his left hand back to the professional gear holster at his left side beneath the sweater. He popped the thumb brake, freeing one of the two Sig Sauer P-228 9mm, stabbing the pistol toward a young officer trying to escape through the still-open door. The wind tore through the room, maps and other documents scattering about in cyclonic patterns. Rourke moved quickly toward the doorway. Gunfire was everywhere on the helipad, a video probe exploding in midair, whether from enemy gunfire or by remote detonation, he could not be certain. Across the helipad, near one of the Nazi gunships, he could barely make out in the momentary glow a small battle raging. Rourke stepped out onto the porch.